Hey, it's Alex Boti, producer with The Takeaway. We've got five stories for you today on our podcast, like Mark Zuckerberg's first statements on the Cambridge Analytica data scandal. We've got an investigation into sex abuse among military kids and how it gets overlooked. And we start with the shooting of Stephon Clark in Sacramento. This is your Takeaway for Thursday, March 22nd, 2018.
He was right there dead. And I told them officers, you guys are murderers, murderers, murderers. You guys killed that baby for nothing. You took him away from his kids for nothing. He didn't even do nothing to nobody.
That's the voice of Saquita Thompson, the grandmother of 22-year-old Stephon Clark, after Clark was shot and killed by police late Sunday night in Sacramento, California. Clark is African-American. He was living at his grandparents' home. Police arrived that night responding to reports that someone fitting Clark's description was breaking car windows in the neighborhood. What happened next was recorded on a helicopter camera and on body cams worn by officers. Clark was pursued by police officers. He ran into his grandparents' backyard. There he was shot by police who said they thought he was armed, as you can hear in this disturbing body cam footage.
Show me your hands! Gun, gun, gun! Shots fired, subject down. Show me your hands!
I see your hands!
When police approached Stephon Clark's body, they found no weapon. His grandmother described the scene she saw through the rear window of her house.
His body was there, right there. Right there was my grandson dead with the iPhone right there on the thing, and I have a picture of it.
Sacramento police later released a message on their Facebook page stating in part that the only item found near the suspect was a cell phone and that they're investigating and working with the community to get to the bottom of what happened. I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway. Anita Chabrier is the senior writer on race, immigration, and social justice for the Sacramento Bee. She joins me now along with Ken Barnes, a public affairs consultant who grew up in Sacramento and lives there now. Anita, Ken, thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you, Todd.
Nice to be here.
Anita, let me start with you. You've seen the body cam footage along with the rest of Sacramento now. You've seen the video from the helicopter and heard the 911 calls. What stands out to you viewing all of these pieces of information together?
There's a couple things, actually, that I think are important about the video. First, it's released 3 days after the event happened. And I do think that's something that needs to be pointed out. That is the result of the killing of an unarmed, mentally ill black man named Joseph Mann that happened in 2016 in Sacramento and led to both a new police chief and a series of reforms. One of those reforms being that video and critical incidents has to be released within 30 days. But this chief has made an unprecedented effort to get it out there even faster. So I do think the department deserves credit for putting this video out so very quickly. The video itself obviously is incredibly disturbing. It happens so fast and it's so chaotic. And you do see the officer shooting within seconds of encountering Stephon. The third thing I think is we cannot underestimate the importance of is that in the aftermath of the shooting, what appears to be a sergeant or a supervisor coming to the scene tells the officers to mute their mics. And that is, to me, a total violation of the spirit of our reforms, if not the letter of them, and it might be a violation of the letter of them as well.
We'll talk more about those reforms and the history going back to the shooting that you described in 2016, Anita. Talk just for a moment, please, about Stephon Clark. What do we know about him?
We know that Stephon was living with his grandparents and some siblings in a neighborhood called Meadowview. It's an area in South Sacramento that historically is a very working class neighborhood, very ethnically diverse, and has always had a tenuous relationship with law enforcement, a lot of community mistrust around law enforcement. He is the father of two. The children are living with their mother in a separate residence. We don't know a whole lot about what he was doing that day prior to that. We know he had left the house around 6 p.m. to go out with friends. And then the next time we know of his whereabouts is on the side of the house where What we do know is that the front doorbell of that home was broken. And so the family and the grandparents are not mobile. The grandfather's in a wheelchair. The grandmother had had open heart surgery. So the habit of everyone staying in the house was simply to go around back and knock on the window, and they would use the garage door opener to open the garage door. So to have Stefan on the side of the house heading to the backyard to the family was a very normal thing.
Ken, what has the reaction in the community been like since the shooting and the several days and the reactions to it?
You know, generally speaking, it's been one of distrust. You know, as Anita pointed out, this is the Meadowview area. I grew up in that neighborhood too. I don't live there any longer. But most of us, particularly Black males, have a fairly long and sordid history with the Sacramento Police Department that stretches back multiple decades. I'm 47, and these are some of the same issues we dealt with when I was a teenager in the 80s. I will say what's about this case that's particularly unique is that the video was released so quickly. And that's a result of, we have a new police chief, Daniel Hahn, who comes from our community. And he's been on the job about 6 months now. And this is a major reform. I mean, the fact that they have 30 days, they did it in less than 3 days, and we're able to kind of witness these things and see what's happening. It's difficult because the force escalation with persons of color, particularly Black males, seems to be so quick. You know, it's an encounter, there's a demand, a command given, and then shots ring out. And so that's kind of at the core of one of the challenges. And then everything's about context, right, Todd? So you look at, she mentioned, you know, Joseph Mann being run down by police officers in July 2016. Just 9 months later, Nnamdi Kane, that a lot of persons across the country know about, was arrested and beat for jaywalking, goes to jail and finds himself abused there. And so that's the context of the trust, not to mention the national things that are happening. So getting to a point to where you can trust the words of the police department and the reports is going to be difficult. But I do think that we've been moving towards that. And this situation, you know, isn't a cut and dry. It's not a black and white situation. It's a tough thing to discuss, but this was someone who was seen on helicopters running and jumping through backyard fences, a 911 call that kind of matches up to the things that they encountered on the ground when the police arrived, and then someone not following commands. I think the main issue here is, you know, but why does it escalate to a 20-shot hail of bullets versus an opportunity for someone to put their hands up, to someone to comply with orders?
Well, Anita, one of the main issues, of course, it's not cut and dry, as Ken says. The main issue, though, it seems in the final analysis, is whether indeed he was armed, and the very quick latency between when cops told him to put up his hands and shots ring out. The video shows officers also going in the dark into the backyard. And then I want to play you one other piece of this. There are a lot of shots, and then several minutes of time before police approach Stefan Clark's body to give him medical attention.
Hey, can you hear us? If you can hear us.
Can you hear us?
We need to know if you're okay. We need to get you medics, but we can't go over there to get you help unless we know you don't have the weapon.
Anita, this is at the point when Stefan Clark is already on the ground, presumably dead, although it's impossible to know at that point. It does take police several minutes to get to him, and this is part of the overall context of this video that I imagine the community is reacting to here.
Absolutely. I think that is something that question was raised at a city hall meeting the day after it happened. It is definitely a question in the community, and it's a question, I think, for all of us. That is a long delay of 7 minutes before anyone even approaches him, much less gives him any kind of aid. And then there is a standard practice. It is their general orders that they handcuff a suspect like that prior to giving aid, and that is another really big sticking point for the community. Does that need to be done when someone's so clearly injured? So absolutely, you're going to see a lot of questions around, was aid given quickly enough?
Now, Ken, you and Anita both mentioned the shooting in July 2016 of an unarmed, mentally ill black man named Joseph Mann that's led to several reforms in the city, and the release of this video footage is part of that reforms. You've lived in the community your whole life. Do you have a sense now that even though another shooting has occurred, that the reforms have taken root in a way that the community feels like the police are more enrolled in accountability here?
I mean, I can't speak for everyone, but for myself personally, I feel that we're moving toward a better outcome, a better set of outcomes, and better accountability on the police department. You know, since that time, we both demanded that there be audio and video cameras on all law enforcement officers. That's happened. We demanded that we have new leadership. We got a new chief. So it does take time. We can't expect a miracle to happen overnight. I will say, talking about the aftermath of the shooting, not only was it concerning that there wasn't aid given much more quickly after the shooting, but muting those mics, those last 2 minutes of the body camera, the reason why that's kind of disturbing, because it leads your mind to race and wonder, you know, are they getting a story together to have it sync up properly? And the thing is, you can leave that audio on. They have the ability to go back in and mute out privacy for privacy purposes, just like they did on the 911 call. So there's really no reason to have a mute happen, it would seem to me, while in the field. That's something that should be looked at administratively after the fact. You know, overall, I think this is going to, you know, how this plays out will be how transparent the law enforcement is with this. To date, I think they've been pretty excellent with it. There's obviously a lot of questions to be answered. And, you know, there's something that maybe is uncomfortable to talk about, but you also have to make sure that police officers go home too. And so it's hard to maybe just pass a snap judgment by saying, hey, look, I saw a couple of little over a video, and so you did something wrong. And it's hard to say that sometimes, particularly when your experience with them has been so ugly. But again, this is not some situation where they hunted someone down or someone was sitting in their backyard having a soft drink. Cops walk in and shoot them dead. And I think to market it as that, to portray it as that sort of instance, that's also unfair to the police department, and doesn't really do anything to try to heal this rift between the community and those that are policing us.
Okay, Ken, let me make sure I end with Anita. Anita, what's next in this investigation?
Accountability. So Ken is right. We have transparency. That is a sea change from our last chief and how the department was run. But what the community wants now is accountability, that next step. You're showing us the information. What are you going to do with it?
Anita Chabrier is senior writer on race, immigration, and social justice for the Sacramento Bee, and Ken Barnes, a public affairs consultant from Sacramento. Anita, Ken, thank you both so much for joining me to talk about the shooting death of Stephon Clark, 22 years old, in Sacramento.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Todd.
Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is in the United States. It's a 2-week tour meeting with business leaders across the country, doing media interviews, and he kicked it all off on Tuesday at the White House with President Trump.
It's an honor to have the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia with us and his representatives, many of whom I know and I met in May when we were over there, where a promise of $400 billion was made by Saudi Arabia for the purchase of our equipment and other things. And the relationship is probably the strongest it's ever been. We understand each other.
The Crown Prince is on a PR mission here in the United States. This is not the conservative, Wahhabist home of Osama bin Laden and misogynist laws. This is a new Saudi Arabia, says Salman, reforming and ready for business that isn't just oil.
What has been this Saudi Arabia for the past 40 years? Is that the real Saudi Arabia?
Absolutely not. This is not the real Saudi Arabia. I would ask your viewers to use their smartphones to find out, and they can Google Saudi Arabia in the 70s and 60s,
and they will see the real Saudi Arabia easily in the pictures.
Salman is a sophisticated man with a sophisticated media strategy. Meanwhile, American news outlets have gotten some criticism for glowing coverage of Mohammed bin Salman, like this report from Nora O'Donnell on 60 Minutes on CBS on Sunday.
Known by his initials MBS, his reforms inside Saudi Arabia have been revolutionary. He is emancipating women, introducing music and cinema, and cracking down on corruption in a land with 15,000 princes.
Well, does that take on MBS, reformer, revolutionary, emancipator of women, tell the whole story? The Intercept reported yesterday that the Crown Prince is close to Jared Kushner, so close, in fact, that before Kushner lost his security clearance, Salman boasted to friends that he has Jared Kushner, quote, in my pocket. So, we wanted to take a closer look at the Crown Prince and see how well the media coverage here in the United States matches up to the reality. Sheila Carapico is professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond. Sheila, thanks for being here.
Thanks for calling.
So let's talk about Mohammed bin Salman back home in Saudi Arabia. He's been busy advertising reforms like letting women drive cars and letting women attend sporting events, appearing at least to crack down on corruption. That famous case, dozens of wealthy and royal Saudis held captive in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh. Why does Salman want to push these reforms and these makeovers now?
To the extent that there's any critical view of Saudi Arabia in the United States, and even more so in Europe, it's for their murderous war in Yemen. And it's not a coincidence that his visit to the United States coincides exactly with the three-year anniversary of the beginning of an unprovoked attack on Yemen. So he's advertising kind of cosmetic changes, like letting women drive, and at the same time avoiding quite successfully, for instance, in the 60-minute piece that you played a little bit of, really avoiding scrutiny of the war. And it also happens that this was supposed to be the week that the resolution brought forth by Bernie Sanders and Senators Murphy and Lee, trying to limit American support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen, came to the Senate. So he's got this media blitz going on in an effort to divert attention from legitimate criticisms of how the conduct of the war. And, of course, second point, there are other things going on in Saudi Arabia. You mentioned the crackdown on corruption, which can also be seen as a purge and a shakedown. And then there's been minimal attention to the horrific human rights abuses inside of the kingdom, including, you know, the flogging of bloggers and repression of Saudi Shia.
Well, President Trump was definitely eager to promote warm relations with Saudi Arabia when Mohammed bin Salman visited the White House there in the Oval Office. We heard it. What's been going on behind the scenes with that relationship?
Well, I don't know, of course, exactly behind the scenes, but I think what's on the scene, what we can see very clearly, is that the president is delighted to continue to sell weapons. He seems to think that the war in Yemen is some sort of American jobs program. And I think that's genuinely how he sees it.
Well, Professor Carapico, we played some cuts from the 60 Minutes interview, an interview which you say glossed over the war in Yemen. If you had a shot at the Crown Prince to ask him one question, what would it be?
Well, I would wish that somebody would ask him a much more direct question along the lines of, what plans have you got to bring an end to the war in Yemen? I mean, he'll respond to that the Houthis have to unconditionally surrender. If you look at the transcript of that interview, he makes it sound like Saudi Arabia was attacked first, which is just so far from any plausible telling of the story. So it would be necessary for a proper journalist to really ask the kind of follow-up questions, you know, to ask the initial question about plans to bring the war to an end, but then to ask follow-up questions that don't allow him to just, you know, basically prey on the fact that the journalists, frankly, a lot of them don't know what's going on. So we also saw last week, usually Saudi Arabia doesn't allow journalists in, but last week they had Steve Inskeep of NPR. Apparently there was a 10-person team from 60 Minutes. There have been some other ones let in. But, you know, they're given a particular script, and they, you know, forfeit their responsibility to ask hard follow-up questions.
Are you suggesting that Steve Inskeep and the team at NPR read from a script given to them by the Saudi government?
No, I wouldn't go that far. But Inskeep's opportunity to cover the war in Yemen was that he was flown to Saudi Arabia, where he was able to do interviews in Saudi Arabia. And then they brought him to one place in Yemen where he could sort of look down from a mountain towards Sana'a. And that was the vantage point that he was allowed to have. So by limiting access and then providing it very selectively, they were able to craft the message quite brilliantly, I think.
Professor Sheila Carapico of the University of Richmond, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Let's go to Peru now, where President Pedro Pablo Kuczynski announced his resignation on Wednesday. The president is accused of accepting bribes from the giant Brazilian construction conglomerate Odebrecht and then lying about it. We're going to talk more about Odebrecht in just a minute. But first, we turn to Reuters correspondent Mitra Taj, who's in Lima, Peru. Mitra, welcome.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Well, Kaczynski's been facing corruption accusations for months, Mitra, a looming impeachment trial. Was it a surprise that he offered his resignation on Wednesday?
At the start of the week, I think it was looking kind of likely that he might survive the impeachment vote because he has new allies from the son of former President Alberto Fujimori, whom he pardoned right after surviving the impeachment bid that he faced in December. So it looks like he kind of had a chance of dividing the opposition even further, but these secret video recordings that the opposition released just 2 days before the vote was set to be held, they showed allies of Kuczynski offering a reluctant opposition lawmaker basically access to public work contracts if he would cast a vote in favor of Kuczynski in the impeachment vote. So it didn't look good at all for him. Some of them are even talking about things that sound very illegal, you know, pocketing part of the money that would be dedicated to a infrastructure project for his region. His government denied, of course, that they were actually engaged in vote buying, but it didn't look good for him.
Now, this is on top of older charges of corruption on the part of the president. What about the older charges that got him moved towards impeachment in the first place?
This all kind of came about in December when the opposition also revealed that he had ties to this Brazilian company Odebrecht, which is at the center of the biggest ever corruption scandal in Latin America. So any kind of association with a company is kind of politically toxic. But they revealed that his own consulting firm had actually received payments from Odebrecht back when he was a finance minister more than a decade ago when the company won some pretty fat contracts by the government. So that just the disclosure that he had connections that he previously denied having was kind of a bombshell. But of course, nothing has been proven. You know, he hasn't faced trial. Prosecutors are investigating things related to Odebrecht that have to do with him. But he denies wrongdoing and says there was nothing illegal about anything that he did.
Well, if he denies wrongdoing, why did Kuczynski resign or at least offer to?
I think he saw that he had no way out. Even some of his strongest defenders, you know, strong loyalists and in Congress, ruling party lawmakers were saying that he needed to step down or they would vote for impeachment. So he saw that there was no way to survive the impeachment bid. And I was told by sources that his cabinet also said that they would abandon him and resign if he himself did not resign.
Well, Mitra, Peru is hosting the Summit of the Americas next month, and the theme is democratic governance against corruption. That's a little awkward.
Yes, it's very awkward. I mean, the entire region is kind of roiling from this Odebrecht scandal. A lot of former presidents, high-ranking officials have been caught up in the scandal. So it definitely is an interesting theme to pick as all of the region's countries are going to gather together. But we'll see if maybe some progress can be made. There's certainly a sense in Peru that everybody's corrupt. There's a lot of disapproval for any kind of elected official or political leader. So I think there's a lot of work to be done.
Anyway, Mitra, Pablo Kuczynski offers his resignation. I guess it'll be accepted. What's next in Peru? Who steps up?
Well, there's a vice president, Martin Vizcarra, who's actually the current ambassador to Canada. So he was on a trip, I think, in Quebec when all of this was happening and is coming back. Basically, he's expected to arrive Thursday night and should be sworn in on Friday.
Well, Mitra, what happens with Kuczynski now? Is he a flight risk?
prosecutors seem to think he is. Shortly after he resigned, maybe just within hours, public prosecutors asked a judge to bar him from leaving the country so that they could have basically access to him while they continue their investigations into Odebrecht. So that's a sign that likely once he loses presidential immunity, will name him as a suspect in an investigation and will continue to probe him.
Mitra Chaj with Reuters in Lima, Peru. Mitra, thank you.
You're welcome.
The name Odebrecht pops up over and over again in coverage of corruption cases across Latin America. Odebrecht is a huge name in construction in South America, places like Brazil and Peru and Argentina. And it's gotten to be a big name in politics as well, but not for positive reasons. Daniel Gallas is BBC South America business correspondent, and he joins me now from Sao Paulo in Brazil.
It's a huge company. I understand a lot of people won't have heard of them, but in Brazil, it's a family business that started out in the 1940s, and they've pretty much done work all over the globe, you know, from Africa to the Middle East to Central America. They built a huge port in Cuba. They built the metro in Caracas. They built World Cup stadiums. They built power plants. So you can see a pattern emerging here. It's just big, huge infrastructure projects, and that most of the contractors for these projects, most of the people who hire Odebrecht are governments. So that's all the source of this corruption scandal.
What do we know specifically about the company's relationships and work in Peru?
Well, Odebrecht is accused of contracting a company called Westfield, which is the company that Pedro Pablo Kuczynski used to work for. Now, he was never very clear about these links with the company, and it also emerged that that Odebrecht gave a few hundred dollars to Pedro Pablo Kuczynski's campaign. Now, the thing with Odebrecht in Peru is that the president who just resigned, he's actually just one of many politicians who's accused of receiving money from Odebrecht. Even the opposition who accuses him of these illegal links, they are also accused in the Odebrecht scandal as well. And the previous four governments in Peru, they all have had links with Odebrecht, at least in some level of accusation. So pretty much Odebrecht had links with every major political player in Peru, which guaranteed that always have a good relation with the government.
And what about in Brazil, where you are right now? Odebrecht is a Brazilian company and has made a lot of headlines there too.
Yes, Odebrecht here is a company founded by a man called Norberto Odebrecht and his son Marcelo Odebrecht. They're two very famous business people, you know, the kind of business people you'd see always winning awards, you know, businessman of the year, best company of the year, best place to work, those sorts of awards. So they were very respected and highly regarded up until 2015 when Marcelo Odebrecht was arrested, and now he's facing all these charges. So what he did, he went into a plea bargain deal. And then since he's helping investigators, he's getting, you know, a better sentence in jails. But he sort of opened a Pandora's box in Latin America, because all of a sudden he revealed all sorts of very, corrupt deals. The thing about Odebrecht is that it is the biggest company in Latin America in construction. But in the case of Brazil, like four or five other big players in construction, they also were in this scandal. So not just Odebrecht, it's part of many construction companies that were involved in this.
At this point, Daniel, it kind of boggles the mind that Odebrecht continues to do business in Latin America implicated in corruption at so many levels.
Yes, well, they have been going through a major restructure since the whole scandal, as all construction companies have had to do in Brazil. They still operate. They're still here. A lot of companies have put sanctions against them. So Petrobras, for instance, which is sort of the biggest company in all of this that was involved in this scandal. Petrobras was hiring Odebrecht for many construction projects. And then a few years ago, when all this emerged, you know, Petrobras directors were also jailed, and Petrobras now had in place some sanctions against Odebrecht. So Odebrecht wasn't able to work with Petrobras, with the Brazilian government in some instances. But those things, with time, Odebrecht tends to get back on its game. But it's a much smaller company today than it was in the past, just because in the past it was considered Latin America's biggest construction conglomerate.
Daniel Gallas, BBC South America business correspondent. Daniel, thank you.
Thank you very much.
T. Tens of thousands of children of American military personnel go to school on bases all over the world. And those schools exist in a kind of bureaucratic netherworld, closely aligned with the military, but not subject to the laws that govern the armed forces. Well, now a new investigation by the Associated Press finds that when students are sexually assaulted by peers at those schools, the incidents often get overlooked. Reese Dunklin says it's a mix of bureaucratic confusion and a lack of clear rules on how to respond to sexual assaults at military-run schools. Reese is a reporter who helped lead the investigation for the AP.
We managed to identify roughly 600 cases over the last 10 years. And we did that despite the military school system's records being incomplete and in disarray. And then even when we asked for the military branches to provide information, that information was incomplete as well. So of the 600 or so cases we found, the military omitted about a third of those.
So what typically happens when there's an assault or an alleged assault and say the parents want to go to the school or go to the leaders of the base where the school is located and report it?
Well, they certainly can report it to the school, and the principal under the military school system's policy is supposed to lead that investigation. But the direction provided to the principals is not very detailed. It's not like a step-by-step directive along the lines of what the school system has for adult-on-student sexual assault. And what the school system has for student-on-student, it's more general in nature, and there were three paragraphs in one of the policies that even mentioned sexual harassment. It wasn't as though they were telling the principals, you have 24 hours and you have to ask these questions of those involved. Separately from the schools, the parents could report this to the police agencies that patrol the military bases and fill out a report. But what we found from there was that some of these cases are shelved. And the investigators who receive these reports, they're shelving the cases and they're not pursuing them as their departmental policy tells them to do.
So parents or guardians of a young girl in school, a girl who is, let's say, sexually assaulted by a classmate, want to go to school authorities or to law enforcement authorities on base. What did you uncover in terms of how authorities respond when parents do take the steps to try to report it?
Well, what we found is when the cases are flowing out of the schools, when they're there on campus, we found examples of them languishing. Parents had complained that school officials did not respond quickly. The actions the school officials took did not seem to halt the inappropriate touching. And in several cases, the parents had talked about feeling left in the dark. They weren't getting many answers out of the school. And the school would say, we can't tell you much because minors are involved and we have to adhere to student privacy. Now, when it's reported elsewhere on base, the investigators may be taking the reports. And even then, the parents aren't always kept in the loop as far as the progress of the investigation.
Well, Reese, what's the accountability structure for schools on military bases here? If parents, ostensibly service members themselves, are dissatisfied with the response they're getting after reporting an assault, or they're just not hearing anything, can they go higher up? Is there a place for them to go?
They can certainly file a complaint with the school system itself. Now that's going to be handled internally by the school system. That's what happened in some of the cases that we reported about coming out of Germany. The parents' recourse was to file a complaint saying that they believed the principal and the school mishandled their reports. And it was investigated internally. And the parents said that they really weren't informed along the way. And at best, one set of parents said that they were simply told the investigation found that the principal was not at fault and no policies were violated. Now, that same group of parents in that same case also decided to go to the base commander and appeal to him, because base commanders can get involved in civilian misconduct, even though military law does not cover civilians. A base commander could take administrative action. And the commander in that case said he really couldn't get involved with the school. It was really a school matter. He made a phone call over to the school, and the principal followed up with the families, but the families felt like that really wasn't a satisfactory outcome.
Well, Reese, I mean, the ultimate responsibility for oversight here rests with Congress. What are lawmakers saying who have jurisdiction over the military?
They responded quickly after our stories had published, and the two committees that oversee the military, one in the Senate and one in the House, both of them have begun demanding answers. And the House Armed Services Committee, in fact, has already said that it's begun an examination. And several other members of Congress have sent letters to the Defense Secretary asking for more information and explanations for how the system has worked, what it's not done well, and what some fixes may be. So I think we're going to see in the next couple of months that information flow back to Congress, and we'll see what Congress decides to do from there.
Reese Dunklin, reporter for the Associated Press. Reese, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This was a major breach of trust, and I'm really sorry that this happened.
Really sorry.
Our responsibility now is to make sure that this doesn't happen again. Because we need to make sure that there aren't any other Cambridge Analytica is out there, and make sure that no one out there is improperly using data. And that's, I think, the responsibility that we have to people in our community. You know, we have a basic responsibility to protect people's data. And if we can't do that, then we don't deserve to have the opportunity to serve people.
That is Facebook creator and chief executive Mark Zuckerberg speaking on CNN last night. It was Zuckerberg's first TV appearance since confirmation broke that Cambridge Analytica used pilfered personal data from more than 50 million Facebook users. Earlier, Zuckerberg posted a message on Facebook explaining how that breach happened and pledging to prevent it from ever happening again. By sheer virtue of its size, Facebook has become far more than just a one-stop shop for baby photos. The platform is a primary mode of communication for millions of users and the primary route to the internet for millions more. And the 2016 election showed that the very algorithms that make Facebook billions of dollars on ads are the ones that enable Russian interests, according to the intelligence community, to meddle in U.S. politics and drive narratives that sow division. So can Facebook handle all of these responsibilities that it signed millions of us up for? Ali Bohm is a policy counsel at Public Knowledge. They're an advocacy group working toward an open internet. Ali, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Ali, as we mentioned, Mark Zuckerberg posted an explanation and an apology to Facebook users. He explained how an app developer developed an app that got lots, 50 million users' data, and how he transferred it over to Cambridge Analytica. Mark Zuckerberg says that couldn't happen today because of changes that they've already made. Where are you on where things stand now with Facebook and its stewardship of users' personal information?
Sure. So I think the Cambridge Analytica moment is evidence that self-regulation for these platforms doesn't work. Facebook was already under a consent decree with the Federal Trade Commission to requiring it to take certain steps to protect its users' privacy and its users' data. It failed to do so. So I think this is the time for Congress to step in and develop comprehensive privacy legislation. Importantly, that needs to not just be about Facebook, because today it's Facebook, and today it's sort of access to data that exceeded authorization, right? So this researcher with Cambridge Analytica got the data in an authorized way. However, it was then used in ways that Facebook had not authorized. Or just a plain old vanilla data breach like we saw with Equifax, like we saw and I think actually got buried with all of the Cambridge Analytica with Orbitz just this week. So there are going to continue to be breaches of data and folks accessing data in ways that were not anticipated, even if they did have authorized access to that data.
I mean, Ali, there's two different sides to what you're describing. There are data breaches, there are unauthorized uses. And then when you look at the political end of this whole question of how Facebook's algorithms are used, it seems like it was used as designed when we look at the way outside interests appear to have pushed fake news, fake narratives on the platform. Two different sides of the same coin. How does that get regulated, or should it be?
So you're right. That's a completely other issue. And I think that one, the sort of misinformation, fake news, lies, if you will, that are being spread through social media is a much more complex issue to tackle, because social media, we do have self-selecting audiences. And so we do end up with fragmented sources of information. I think that that one is a hugely pressing problem that needs to be addressed, and that we as advocates and Congress should be thinking about how to address it. I think we have many more answers around the privacy data breach, exceeding authorized access to data questions, right? So we can think about, do we know what information is being collected about us? Can we meaningfully consent to that information being collected? Do we know where that information is being shared? Can we meaningfully consent before it is shared? Can we meaningfully consent to particular uses and decline other uses? Do we know how long that information is being retained? Do we have a say? Can we say, you know, after 2 years, I actually, you know, don't want to see memories on Facebook from 5 years ago. Maybe, you know, can I choose to say after 2 years, delete my posts from 5 years ago? I don't want that coming up again. And Europe is looking at some of this stuff in the GDPR, that's the General Data Protection Regulation. And so Facebook and the other platforms are going to have to learn to make granular user controls.
Ali, let's talk about how some of these regulations might be achieved, if indeed they are. You say comprehensive privacy regulation is required here. A lot of people right away blurt out that word utility. Facebook is so big and so important to access to the internet for so many hundreds of millions of people that it's like the phone company. It's like the electric company now. It's just a utility. Is it? And what would that mean if, let's say, Congress decided that it was a utility?
Well, so let's talk about what a utility is, because that's sort of different from the idea of common carriage. It's also different from the idea of a public forum. So a utility is something that we think is so vital as a society that it is the government's obligation to make sure that everyone has access to it at a reasonable rate. So that's something like the phone lines are a utility. Electricity is a utility. My organization strongly advocates that broadband internet should be a utility. You need that to participate in the digital age. Facebook is not a utility. No one is saying everyone needs to have access to Facebook the way that you need to have a phone on every farm, right? People are choosing now to delete Facebook. Many people have chosen never to join Facebook. Facebook may have some obligations, and you know, we can think about what we want from Facebook. Do we want it to be something everyone has access to on an equal basis? I mean, that's something like common carriage. You have to accept all comers and charge them reasonable rates. That's like hotels and buses. But we don't say every community has to have a public bus system. That would make it a public utility. Is it something like a public forum where we say anyone can speak and share their opinion here subject to reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions? So I think the question we should be asking is the concern and the harm that we're trying to address about speech and trust, or is it about the cost of an essential service and making sure there's access to an essential service?
Ali Bohm, Policy Counsel at Public Knowledge. Ali, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Chris Liggett from Atlanta, Georgia. My opinion of Facebook was never high. I only started using it to keep up with my children. Now I use it only rarely, just to find out what my motorcycling buddies are up to. Since the data breaches, I have reduced my use of Facebook to a few times per week. I've always had my privacy settings at the maximum.
My name is Joyce. I'm from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I use Facebook all day long from the time I get up in the morning until when I turn it off at bedtime. I've always assumed that they use my data and my friends' data in ways that I couldn't even fathom. It's the trade-off that you make when you sign in. I don't intend to change how I use it.
This is Rhonda Carr calling from Portland, Oregon. And I use Facebook to stay connected to family and friends. I will continue to use Facebook for that purpose, However, I am no longer going to be using it to connect to apps, and sadly, no more silly quizzes. I'm not sure how I'll find out which Facebook friend will bail me out of jail, who my soulmate is, or what my profile picture says about my future, but I guess I'll manage.
This is Les Hemmingson. I'm calling from Beaverton, Oregon. I don't use it. I don't trust it. I wouldn't trust it any more than I'd trust a poisonous snake. I believe that Facebook is living proof that you can get certain people to believe anything.
This is Nikki Mohammed Fauzi calling from Arlington, Texas. I am currently in the process of deleting the 47 or more apps that I previously allowed access to my data, and from now on I will scroll right past them and any of the quizzes or clickbait types of articles in the future.
Hi, my name is Damani. I'm calling from Brooklyn, and I use Facebook for both business and personal. It's not that our data is being sold. That bothers me. It's the fact that companies purchasing this data may not operate ethically. And how can we blame Facebook for that?
So many of you takeaway listeners turning away from Facebook. It's been a great discussion. You can always leave a comment, of course, on our Facebook page where so many of you do talk to us. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.